Good evening, and welcome to yet another episode of The Last Knock. Your friends in horror since 2013. I am one of your hosts. My name is Johnny Numb, and joining me, as always, is
Billy Crash.
first and last and always Bill.
Wow, man, that is an awesome Sisters of Mercy album, man, right there.
It is. Or maybe I should say first, second, and last. I don't know what I'm talking about. We did an episode recently on the 30th anniversary of Stephen King's Graveyard Shift, the movie.
Yay.
Yeah, and that was yeah, that's surprising, yay, because we didn't like that movie when we first saw it. Neither one of us liked it.
Nope, which is odd.
Yeah, and then and then we both had rewatched it and we liked what we saw for some reason, and we hopefully articulated that. So I got this idea in my head. Well, what about other movies that we've watched through the years that maybe didn't connect with us on a first viewing, and maybe we get a weird itch to take another look at them for whatever reason. And then we discover, oh my God, I like this now. And here's why I like it. So that's the idea of our show tonight is I was calling it second chance horror. Just stuff that we didn't stuff that was kind of eh or really bad, and we now like it. So simple enough. And I won the coin toss before the show, so Bill said I could go first. And I'm, something interesting is that a lot of these movies, or the movies I thought of, a bunch of them are from directors I really, really, really like.
Oh, that's interesting.
And these films, some of them were kind of just like anomalies in their filmographies. Like, oh, I love this, this, and this, and then I saw this, and I was like, yeah. So why don't I start with Repulsion?
Ah.
And I know you've seen that one, Bill.
Yeah, and you know what? And it's funny, before you go, I've been meaning to rewatch that one because I wasn't impressed with it either first time around.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I think there's going to be some stories behind how we saw these films, when we saw them, and when we revisited them, because I watched this one. I took a hiatus from college for a few years, and then I went back into it back in the early to mid 2000s. And I was renting movies from the York College Library like a fiend. And, because they had a lot of good art house stuff, a lot of classics, and this was when DVD was really starting to proliferate. So, that's how I watched rewatched Rosemary's Baby. That's how I first watched The Tenant because they had that on their shelf.
Great movie.
Yeah, I love that. That's my favorite Polanski. And at some point, I didn't. I watched Repulsion through someone else's DVD. And it was like a full frame presentation, so it was cropped. And it was obviously not mastered very well. It was probably just taken right from a VHS tape. But, that aside, I just wasn't really compelled by the film. And I think it was a matter of pacing with it. I felt like, man, this just seems to kind of drag on. It's repetitive with Catherine Deneuve's fantasies, or are they fantasies?
Dun, 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 dun.
Of her being, violated by mysterious men when the bell at the convent chimes each night. So I was just kind of like, man, this really isn't doing it for me. I just. It's strange because I felt like kind of as disaffected as Catherine Deneuve looked throughout the movie, kind of. And I also thought her character was kind of like I wanted more from her character, maybe a bit selfishly. was that, oh my God, I wish she would talk more. I wish she would do more than just make these weird, you know, just make these weird gestures with her nose and do the beady eyes thing. I wish she would do more. You know, so the movie, I saw it and I didn't necessarily forget about it because, you know, Polanski, even at that time, was one of my favorite filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then a couple years after that, Criterion, as they are wont to do, they put out a nice Blu-ray version of the movie. So, of course, it's like, well, Barnes & Noble has their 50% off sale, so I picked it up one time just in anticipation of giving it another look. And, you know,
right.
I know they do great restorations and they get together good supplements. And watching the movie like on Blu-ray was fantastic. It looked so much better than the version I'd seen prior. But I was also able to connect with the film in a manner that was, I guess I was more familiar with the themes of Polanski's filmography. And I think that helped me connect more with the Carol character, the Catherine
right.
Deneuve character in the film. So I was like, and I'd probably seen a bunch more art house stuff between those two points to kind of like, you know, it's like, oh, I'm watching these movies with more leisurely paces. And, you know, there's more symbolism and there's less explanatory dialogue. It's more an internal film.
Yeah.
You know, definitely more of an internal film because it's taken from Carol's perspective and how she views men, how she views just people in general,
mm-hmm.
and how repulsed, how horrified she feels towards the outside world and everything it contains, basically. But the apartment that she inhabits, which she inhabits with her sister, is just as frightening a place to her because all of these weird manifestations start to coalesce, like the crack in the wall that keeps growing, the cooked rabbit that just rots on a tray, and, you know, the hands that come out of the walls trying to grab at her. I was like, all that imagery and symbolism and metaphor just kind of like really clicked with me that time. You know, and I just found myself getting more lost in the film and its, you know, enigmatic nature. And it's very ambiguous. Even in the end, you don't get a lot of explanation, really no explanation from Polanski and Gerard Brock's screenplay.
No, you don't. And I think one of the great things about Repulsion, and this is why I want to revisit it, is because of the images from the film, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It was, the cinematographer was Gilbert Taylor, who passed in 2013, but he was the cinematographer for Star Wars, the original, Flash Gordon.
Wow.
Also The Omen, and... you know, he did some music videos. He did Dracula 1979. And so, you know, his work on that, I think, is really key because he's, you know, he's the one who's actually telling the story and, mm-hmm. you know, to a degree. But that's part of the reason I want to revisit it because I, you know, it's almost like I couldn't appreciate art films at one time and now I can. So it's like I have a different, you know, approach.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and I think that's another thing with this one, Bill, is that it is a bit of a timeless movie. Like if you'd watch it today with the whole Me Too movement and everything like that, I mean, it's kind of the way it perceives men and the way it perceives the sexes, I think, is very interested and is still actually very kind of attuned to attitudes that still exist. Kind of to this day, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Nice, man. That's a good one.
Yeah. So what do you got, Bill?
Well, it's funny. I'm going to go back to 1933.
Oh, wow. Right.
Yeah. Claude Rains' portrayal in the James Whale film of The Invisible Man. And when I first saw it as a kid, I'm like, you know, whatever. And, you know, like... It's like, okay, he's invisible. This is pretty ridiculous, whatever. And then I saw it probably a year and a half ago, and I'm like, man, Claude Rains was an asshole. It was just like, it was, they always say, oh, have sympathy for the monster. And the Invisible Man, you can't. He's just like totally murderously insane. He's bonkers. And I'm like, this is really horrific. I mean, when you see all these police standing around and they're all looking like, oh, like what's going on? And it's like Claude Rains is laughing and just like killing everybody. It's just, it just blew me away. Because, the horror isn't just that, well, we can't see him. It's the guy's nuts and he's on a murder spree and he'll kill anything that moves. And, it's like, what do you do? Like, what do you do to that with that? And I was like, man, this is really, I looking, putting it back into perspective. I think when I saw it the second time, I'm like, I can't believe they made this movie this like vicious for 1933. I don't know how many would he do kill 150 people in that movie? I have no idea. But it was just like, it was just the insanity, and that's part of, I think, the horror of it as well is how do you fight insanity? It's like you can't. No, reason doesn't work. Logic doesn't work. Common sense, like, no, everything's just thrown out the window. And it's just so when I saw it when I was a kid, I was like, I probably wasn't even paying attention. It's like, yeah, okay, he's invisible. And now I'm like, holy crap! It's just. So I really, really appreciated, this is from the H.G. Wells story. And I just really appreciated what Claude Rains actually brought to the role because, if you think about a lot of the movies that he's been in, his stature as an actor, it's like, oh yeah, you're in this horror sci-fi movie. You're going to play an invisible man. He could have gone, what a piece of shit is this? I'm contracted to play it, like whatever. And he really sank his teeth into it. And he made it. I mean, I was trying to think of any other actor in that movie playing that role. They might not have been able to bring him to life because he was a real foreboding figure. In fact, it was reminiscent to me of like Charles Laughton in Island of Lost Souls, where he really owned that role. And you're like, holy crap, this guy's really dangerous, And so I really appreciated it much more as an adult. And that's why I want to revisit a lot of older films because maybe I just blew them off, when I was younger, instead of like really appreciating what they did and how they did it at that particular time. So yeah, the Invisible Man, just great stuff.
That's a good choice, Bill, because I think I only watched that for the very first time maybe last year, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think there's some interesting stuff in those James Whale movies,
Oh yeah.
like Frankenstein. Apparently, there was this controversial line, or it was controversial for the time, and some prints cut it out, like where Colin Clive goes. Once the monster starts moving, he says, "Oh, for the love of God, now I know what it feels like to be God." That was
Yeah,
the line
yeah.
that they cut out.
Yep.
and I was surprised that in The Invisible Man, when the townsfolk walk into from the people at the boarding house walk into his room, and he's in the midst of like taking his shirt off and whatever, he's like, he's just having a time of it, and he's like saying, "Oh, I can kill, I can do this," and he says, "I can rape." I was like,
Yup,
"Okay, sure."
exactly.
In a 1930s movie, okay, go ahead, man.
Yeah,
So
I know. It's like, geek.
I was really surprised to hear that. So it's kind of like there is that element and notion of insanity going on to what you were saying, Bill. In the Invisible Man from this year, the Elizabeth Moss one, and
Yeah, I still have to see that.
I rewatched Hollow Man recently. I think it's just a thing of invisible men in movies. They're just assholes. They're just jerks.
I can do whatever I want. Yeah, it's like this hubris and this egomania, this godlike power. People can't see me. I could do whatever I want. It's like, oh my gosh, what a dangerous combination.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin Bacon is such a tool in Hollow Man. I was just like,
Yeah.
man, he is such a douchebag. Yeah. But Yeah, so maybe that's just a thing. You go crazy, or you go crazy from boredom of being invisible, and you just do whatever the heck you want. I don't know.
I'd rob a bank.
I
Sorry, did I say that out loud? Well, I wouldn't rob it. They wouldn't know I'm there. You can't see me. Hey, wait, somebody's casting a shadow, but we can't. I'm gonna punch where he might be. Ow! I'm trying to rob you.
who's walking away with those big sacks of money with dollar signs on them?
Nothing, nobody here. Just try and skip out. I'd spray it with my magic invisible dust, and then nobody could see the money I stole, so I'm rich, but I can't spend it. And it's like, oh man, sorry, just go ahead.
That's what you need. You need an invisibility cloak for your money too.
Oh wow, man, that sounds very Romulan.
Yeah, it's not good enough just to turn yourself invisible. You got to turn the stuff you're stealing invisible too.
Yeah, oh yeah, I'd put my car in a cloak. No, that would be bad. People be friggin' banging into my car. We couldn't see you. Oh, really? It's like, sorry, I digress rapidly.
Well, Bill, another director that the two of us are big fans of. Most people who are into the genre are big fans of him. It's the Canadian master of venereal horror, David Cronenberg.
Yes.
And the movie I'm going to talk about, maybe it's not the one people are thinking of. It's Dead Ringers from '88.
Ah.
And you've seen that one, right,
Oh,
Bill?
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I first discovered Cronenberg, and I guess I actually actively started seeking out his movies like in my late teens. So we'd go to the local video store, and I'd pick up, I was old enough to rent R-rated movies, so my dad didn't say anything. So I'd like pick up Naked Lunch or, whatever I could find that I knew Cronenberg had done. And I picked up Dead Ringers and I watched it and I was kind of left cold by it. I was disappointed. And because again, it was almost like repulsion where I was like, it was like I didn't feel anything. I watched this. It's like it's well made. I can appreciate the production effort and Jeremy Irons as a performer doing this tricky role where he had to play twins.
Beverly and Elliot. Beverly and Elliot. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so I remember being disappointed by it, and
Genevieve Bouljol, don't forget her.
yeah, and she's I came around to her performance. Again, she's very much an ice queen in that film too, in a couple different ways. And yes, so being Cronenberg, being even at that time he was growing into one of my favorite directors. I was always kind of like just always mindful of Dead Ringers and just in general some of the few other movies I don't really care for by him. And I was just always like, you know what? Because he's Cronenberg, or like because David Lynch is David Lynch, or Polanski, I'll give their stuff another shot, whereas I might not be so generous with other filmmakers. So years later, I revisited the film. There was a DVD, I think Warner's put it out, and thinking a couple years had passed at least, and I was like, okay, I'm willing to sit through this. I feel like I've forgotten most of it, so it'll probably be like watching it brand new again. And yeah, it played much better for me. It seemed a lot more the things in it seemed a lot more queasy to me, kind of like some of the procedurals, the medical procedure stuff that they go through, and just in general, kind of the spiral that the twins go through in the film is pretty tragic. But it's weird because it's weird because Elliot is kind of a sleaze bag, because he's having sex with patients at the at his at their gynecology practice.
It sounds like a
And
porn film, doesn't it?
yeah, I know. I mean, I'm sure there's
Hey, how you doing? Let
I
me
don't know. I'm
inspect
sure.
you. Sorry.
You know what, Bill? There is probably like a double ringers or something porn version out there.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, I appreciated you know the dual performance more by Irons and Genevieve Bujold's performance is kind of like she's stuck in the middle of these two characters. But I like how she's kind of superficial in some ways because she's an actress. And she's presented as kind of a little bit vapid near the beginning. It's like, oh, she just wants to have a baby. She's just, but she's also very cold in that actorly way. It's kind of like, I just, no public goodbyes, you know, just, I gotta go do this movie. Just, you know, it is what it is. And, but the more I watched it, the more I picked up on the nuances of Beverly and Elliot and the way. Irons depicted those characters because the first time I watched it, I was like, I don't see a difference between these two guys, and that was a problem for me. And I realized it was probably because the movie was just smarter than I was, and I just wasn't very attuned to like nuance at that time. And the more I watched it, the more I was like, man, Irons is doing some really interesting stuff here. He's really capturing these subtleties. And in the third act of the film, it goes completely, I don't want to say bonkers in the sense that people are thinking, it's just bonkers in the sense that each time you see Beverly and Elliot, it's like their personalities are flipping back and forth to the point where one character is saying, it's getting harder to tell the two of you apart. So they almost do become this one weirdly synchronous thing. I don't know how to say it.
You
It's
have to
very,
watch it, ladies and gentlemen. You have to watch it for yourself.
it's an experience, you know? And if you don't feel it connects with you on a first go around, give it another chance somewhere down the road because you might change your tune like I did. It's a fascinating movie. It's kind of a precursor to where Cronenberg. It was I think it was his first movie after The Fly, and then I think this was when he started. I feel like this is when he started transitioning more into just bizarre dramatic stuff that was kind of setting aside. Like I think he did Naked Lunch soon after,
Oh, that's one of my
but.
that's my one of my favorites from him.
Yeah, which it is a great movie, but it's like he finds ways to, you know, it's like he kind of went into doing drama, but he still retains some of his idiosyncrasies, you know.
Thankfully.
Yeah, so definitely, yeah.
Awesome, man.
Yeah.
Well, I'm taking us back again. We're going in order because my third one's a doozy, and I think people would be like surprised. The Wolfman,
Oh, okay.
1941, Lon Chaney Jr., Claude Rains again as Sir John Talbot. And I don't know, I think when I watched this as a kid, I just wasn't taking it seriously. You know, the dramatic music, black and white, they're in, you know, Europe, and you know, the sweeping music of this hairy guy, you know, running around. It's like, yeah, whatever. And so it was funny, like, you know, several years ago, I'm like, it's on, I'm watching it. And this is one of the true sympathy for the monster films of all time, you know, just like Frankenstein, you know, 1931. Sympathy for the monster, and I mean Frankenstein's monster, not Dr. Frankenstein. And sympathy for the Wolfman because this poor guy, Larry Talbot, he goes to Europe and he's an American, and this woman's being attacked in the forest. He helps her, he gets bitten by a wolf. So, you know, guess what happens? And you know, he turns into a werewolf, and it's like he's the nicest guy in the world, and he becomes this beast, this monster that he can't control. And it's just so sad. To me, it's one of the saddest horror movies ever made. It's just to see this form, this transformation of this nice guy into being a killer, and he doesn't want to be a killer. He doesn't want to hurt anybody. And it's like, well, what do? Well, you got to put him down. And it's like just so awful. It's like really a gut-wrenching film. So as you know, I'm older and you know, like what we've been discussing is we're bringing, anytime we watch something, we're bringing our life experiences to it. But as we grow and change, when we review something again, there's a pretty good chance that might change as well, how we perceive a particular movie or, you know, whatever. And so that happened to me. I watched it and I'm like, I've really got engrossed in the story because it's like, he's a great guy. And it's like, he doesn't get the girl, you know, he doesn't get the house, he doesn't get the manor, he doesn't get the money, he doesn't get anything except an early grave because he went to help somebody and he got bit by a wolf and there was no way you could reverse it. And it's weird because I'm wondering, so what's the message here that George Wagner wanted to send? And Kurt Siodmak, who wrote it, is it like, don't help people because you don't know what bad things can happen to you? Or it's like, is it worth it? Because he did, he saved a life and he sacrificed himself inadvertently without knowing. And isn't that really an exemplary thing to do? Because he was heroic, but he did pay an awful price for it. And I just think it's wonderful for Bela Lugosi fans. He's in it as Bela, and the great Maria Ospenskaya is in it. She plays Maliva, the gypsy woman. What's that? I got to read that segment. It's just too fun. Yeah, she tells Larry Talbot, whoever is bitten by a werewolf and lives becomes a werewolf himself. And he says, ah, don't hand me that. You're just wasting your time. You know, real American talk. And she said, the wolf bit you, didn't he? Yeah, he did. It's like, go now, heaven help you. You know, it's like,
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
yeah. And it's like, it was almost like the play on like the ignorant American, like, ah, I don't believe this crap. Ah, you know, and it's like, and then he got bit. It's like, holy smokes. You know, it's like,
Well, and that's like a trope that became like kind of the regular in horror films is I wouldn't call Larry Talbot the ugly American. He's
no,
not
he
he's not
wasn't
he's
ugly.
he he's not a bad guy.
No, not at all.
But it's kind of like that's like the skeptic in the group, and you know, and yeah, I to back to what you said, Bill, about what kind of message is the movie trying to send. That's a really good point. Do you think there's some relevance to the notion of it's like I'm gonna save this person, you know, despite what the cost could be to me, or just kind of like acting impulsively in the moment. Whereas, you know, some people would not intervene
Right.
in something, and you know, the classic scene in Irreversible where, you know, Monica Bellucci's in that tunnel, you see someone at the end of the tunnel noticing what's happening. They watch it for like a couple seconds and then they just run away because they don't want to get into it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Even with all of that, I'm like, you have to do something. You have to do something. 'Cause I always think, what if that was me? I would want somebody to help me. And we see it all the time. We see selfless sacrifice all the time. And that's a beautiful thing. That's humanity, you know. Especially if it's somebody you don't know. It's like, you know, I have to help that person. And you know, I've had moments in my life where I've helped people, and I've had moments, and I remember them. I remember the ones where I didn't help people. I remember once I was driving home, a bad car wreck, and a guy's in the middle of the road trying to wave me down. And I was young and dumb, and I'm like, I'm exhausted, I'm going home. And there were no cell phones at the time, and I know the person behind me stopped, but I'm like, I wouldn't do that now. There's no way. I would hit the brakes. I'm on the phone. You need help? You know, I've had, you know, I was a first responder. What do you need? You know what I mean? I could do those things. Back then, I was just an idiot, and I always feel bad about that, and I remember that distinctly. Because it was to me one of the low points of my life because I didn't do something what I should have. So like if I'm in the woods and a woman's being attacked, you know, like by a werewolf, it's like, yeah, I gotta do it, you know. And it's not like because you know I want to, you know, like get accolades or anything like that, but it's like, what if, you know, what if you did know her? What if that was you? You want somebody to help. And you know, I have a book on Congressional Medal of Honor award winners, and each page is a is the story about why this person won the award. And most of them are given posthumously. And in most of the situations, it's like someone, you know, in this case, a man in, you know, in the United States service was put in a position where, as they're telling the story, it's like this guy knew he was going to die, but he knew that if he could take action, he might be able to save some other people's lives, his buddies and whatnot. And I think that's beyond admirable. I remember distinctly, and I think it's really important, there a U.S. ship in World War II was hit by a round in the magazine section. The magazine is where they have all the powder for the gun turrets and such. Fire broke out. Bad thing. These two guys rush into the room. They're wounded everywhere from shrapnel. And the thing's getting ready to just burst and just explode. And they got a hose. And they were fighting a fire, these two guys, these two sailors, while other sailors were rushing in to get out the wounded.
Wow.
And the wounded were out, and they were backing out, and it blew, and they were both killed. And I know, because I was in the Coast Guard, I had my fire training and all, you know, like, this isn't good, you're not going to make it. They knew, but they wanted to help other people out. They wanted to, like, maybe, like, these five guys can be saved. And it's like, that's reading the stories just gives me chills, because I always, because it's like, gee, if I was in that situation, could I do it? And, you know, and that's exemplary heroism. So Larry Talbot, you know, he took action in the movie. He went to help this person. He suffered a price he never expected, never knew. But I bet you if you asked him, was it worth it because you saved this person, he would have said yes.
Yeah, I like that, Bill. And I think something else is, like, when you're younger watching those Universal movies in general, it's like you're just wowed by the effects. And the atmosphere and the sets, like the makeup on Karloff, the makeup, Jack Pierce makeup on Lon Chaney for the Wolfman. And I think, like you said, as we get older, I think we start to view things like once we mature kind of, and we, because as kids, it's like, oh, man, that's cool. You know, that's cool looking.
Yeah, exactly.
When we get older, it's more like a more life experience. And you know, you pick up on, is there kind of a moral to things? I think that's something that kicks in. And you do feel the tragedy of that character in that movie.
So, oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. So I really appreciate it now. I think it's just really wonderful.
Yeah, well, I like this contrast that we're working on, Bill, because most of my stuff is more current by comparison, so this is cool.
My next one's current.
Okay. Well, I'm going to talk about, I could have easily populated this entire show with remakes because I actually have grown to like a bunch of them, but I'm just going to pick one for the purpose of this show.
All right.
Because it's a movie that I walked into probably with something of a bad attitude toward it, because I maybe didn't feel that it had any right to exist. And I guess that's kind of a common take among people who just in general object to remakes. I swear I'm not that guy anymore. I'll watch anything. But it's the 2009 version of Last House on the Left.
Ah, okay, cool.
You know, Wes Craven's 1972 film is very much a cult favorite at this point. Arrow put out a big old special edition of it not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people love that movie. You know, it's garnered quite a following. People really hold it up on a pedestal for various reasons.
Right.
You know, oh, it's transgressive and it's depiction of violence and the Love Generation, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, you think of a movie like that that's very much of its time, but still has the ability to shock in certain ways. And then you transpose it into the hands of Rogue Pictures, which was a branch of Universal at the time.
Right.
And you're like, okay, how are you going to do an R-rated version or R-rated remake of Last House on the Left in 2009, what are you going to do to somehow, I don't want to say freshen it up, but make the material
harsher.
Yeah, exactly. Harsher against like the parameters of an R rating, which I feel in some ways I feel are different than they were back in the 70s, which were a bit more freewheeling and
agreed,
a bit more, you know, but in any case, so I actually went to the theater and I watched this movie. There are a few other people in the theater, just a weekday matinee. And I remember just being kind of like meh about it afterwards. I was just kind of like, okay, yeah, they did some things in here that I wasn't expecting them to, but there's stuff that I don't think works. You know, there's kind of a sentimental score going on that I don't really like. There's certain overly stylized things. I don't want to say stylized like in the Nicholas Winding Refn sense, but just like things director Denis Iliadis would do with the camera. Like he'd do stuff with slow-mo, he'd do kind of weird angles, and I'm like, yeah, I don't know if we needed that. I don't know if that's really contributing to the reality that he wants to establish.
Right.
So I was kind of turned off by more the aesthetics of the film than the actual content. And it does reconfigure some things with one of the characters in the film. Their fate is different than in the original, which is a big divergence.
Right.
So for whatever reason, you know, a couple years pass, I think I'm walking through, I'm browsing the movies at FYE at Park City. And I don't know if FYE is even there anymore, but you know, I was just like, oh, they had Last House on the Left, like probably a bunch of copies of it, and it was like under $10. So I was like, oh, you know what? I've been feeling a strange, odd desire to revisit this film, so why the heck not? So I picked it up. And I rewatched it, and I was just like so kind of surprised at how the film kind of impacted me.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this... Stephen King had said at some point that it was his favorite movie of the new millennium, actually, in a Fangoria article. And maybe a little of that was creeping into, like, in terms of me giving it a little reconsideration. And just it just hit with such impact. I watched the unrated cut of it, which is a little longer than the R-rated version. And the stuff that's in there is horrible. You know, the characters they're as bad as they were in the original film, but I think they're more complicated in the new version.
Right.
You know, the stuff with Krug, played by Garrett Dillahunt, who's great, and his son, played by Spencer Tree Clark. The dynamic between the two of them is really interesting because because the son is more kind of like passive. He's kind of just like sitting back observing most of the awful stuff that's going on. And he's not like his dad. So who knows how he was the end product, you know, of being Krug's son. But he's like, he's very much not into what his dad and his gang are up to, you know, with poor Mary, played by Sarah Paxton, who's fantastic.
Yeah. Phenomenal.
Yeah, this was like such a tough sequences to watch with her, but
and they took the whole comedic element out of it with the stupid bumbling cops.
Yes, and thank you for bringing that up, Bill,
because that was Wes Craven's mistake.
Oh yeah, and even he said something on the DVD, like the early MGM DVD of Last House on the Left, he was saying, yeah, I look back at some of the comedic stuff and I cringe. And I'm like, yeah, because it's like you didn't trust the material.
I think you wanted to give the audience a break, and it's like that was your fault. You know, you let them off the hook. And that's why I don't really appreciate that one at all.
Yeah, that's kind of like why when you watch Martyrs, there's no... There's no room to breathe, basically, let alone laugh in that movie.
Laugh. If you could get a laugh out of Martyrs, something's really seriously wrong with you.
Yeah, please leave me alone if you Laugh at Martyrs.
Indeed.
But yeah, with this new version of Last House on the Left, it's really grown on me. And Craven himself kind of handpicked Denis Iliadis as the director after seeing some of his other work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, while it took me until a second viewing to really connect with it, I'm like, I'm glad I did, because it's really tough to watch. And it is tough for a mainstream movie, I think. I think they found ways to make it as tough as the more intense scenes in the original film, but there's also a heart and a depth, and there's kind of a moral to it, kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the performances are pretty great. You know, Tony Goldwyn I thought was fantastic as the dad, and you know, because he really conveys a sense of pain and and rage in that film, but he's also really vulnerable at the same time. And Aaron Paul, who
mm-hmm.
you know, we all know as Jesse from Breaking Bad, is really awful in the movie. So
yeah.
It's like you want to see a more unsympathetic version of Jesse Pinkman. There you go. Yeah.
Quite.
So yeah.
Nice, man. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Oh, well, mine is like a surprise, because my buddy Don Reamer told me many years ago, he's like, Bill, you're looking for a good horror movie to watch. You need to watch this one by such and such a director. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I've never heard of it. I mean, I know like all his work. I don't recall hearing it. So I put in this thing. It's called Prince of Darkness by by John Carpenter, who also wrote it. And the cast is amazing. Donald Pleasance, Jameson Parker, Victor Wong, the beautiful and unfortunately gone Lisa Blount, Dennis Dunn, and Dirk Blocker in it too, man. It was just but anyway, the list goes on. Alice Cooper. And I'm watching this movie, and I'm like, what the frick, man? Like, I don't know what it was. I've been trying to rack my brain about why the movie registered like zero in my head at the time. I don't know if I was depressed. I don't know if I was in some weird situation with a person and I'm like, I got to get out of this relationship. I have no idea. I don't know. But for some reason, I'm like watching Prince of Darkness and I'm like, what's the big deal? What the hell is he talking about? But I knew after watching it, I was like, it's me. I know it's got to be me. So I waited like, I don't know, like a year or two, and I went back to it and I put it in and I'm like, this movie is phenomenal. It's fantastic. It's brilliant. In so many ways, I love it. It's one of my go-to horror films. Like if there's nothing on, I'll put in, you know, I think I should do a list on an article on my go-tos. And and this is one of them. Because it's so cool. It's a science and religion come together to unravel a mystery. And there are certain things I wish John Carpenter had done with the story, but that doesn't negate how awesome the film is by any way. I always had this question in my head. The scientists are like trying to analyze this particular thing. And is it the devil? Like, what's going on? And I was like, but nobody's in the room with it. And I thought that was a great way of him and religion both showing distance from any sort of anomaly, anything like, it's like, yeah, we'll take a look at it, but we won't get really close and really take a look at it. And I thought that was a great commentary on both science and religion. And it has one of the best endings in horror ever. I love it. And it also is one of the creepiest elements in horror, where John Carpenter used a regular, like, cheap video camera at one point to film a part of it, and the creep factor just goes right through the roof with it. And it's a very engaging film. Donald Pleasance plays the priest. Who doesn't want to see that? You know, he goes to Victor Wong, who's Professor Howard Barak, and he takes his grad students, like, we're going to look at this thing this old church has, and we're going to determine if it's something substantial or not. And you will not be saved. That's all I'm going to say. But I don't know why. I still don't get it. It's like the first time I watched it, I just didn't register at all. And then after that, like every viewing, I love it more and more and more. I don't know why. I don't know why I really didn't care for it the first time. And I've been trying all week to figure out what that was. I don't know. It just didn't hit. And then it did. And I remember going to my buddy and saying, you know, you told me to watch that movie and I thought it sucked. And then I watched it again and like, I want to buy a dinner. You know, it's like,
buy a dinner and talk quantum physics for a while. Yeah.
Oh man. I love it. I want more. I would love more horror movies like that.
You know, Bill, it's funny that you brought that one up because that was actually on my list.
No
as well.
Shit.
You know, and it was just I had to cut something, so it was kind of serendipitous here. This was like a similar Dead Ringers case to me. I watched it kind of early on in my fanfare of John Carpenter, so I'd seen like Halloween, The Fog, and you know these movies have identifiable monsters in them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Prince of Darkness is more conceptual, and I think that's what turned me off of it, you know, because it's the green goo in the cylinder. What's scary about that? Ooh, big music cue. Oh, what's scary about the green goo, you know? What's scary about the freaking zombies walking around? It's just like, I think at the time I was too young to wrap my head around.
Yeah, yeah, I hear you.
What he was trying to do, and I think the movie went over a lot of people's heads because I don't think it was successful at all.
And I think it's one of his greatest films, man.
You know what? It's when people ask, "Oh, what's your favorite John Carpenter film?" and they give you Halloween, Escape from New York, and they give you The Fog, and they give you something else popular. I'm like, give me Prince of Darkness all day, every day.
Yeah, I could really. The Thing is my other go-to horror. I could, and The Fog. I mean, I love. Mm-hmm. I'm doing a list. I'm gonna rate all the John Carpenter films best to worst.
Oh, that's good. I like that.
Including the phenomenal Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah, just put everything in there, man.
Oh, everything's going in, baby. Everything's going in.
Make that stew, man. Make that stew really tasty. Yeah.
Yeah. All his feature films. I'm not gonna do any of the video shorts because like he directed. You know, he has 32 director's credits, but.
Yeah.
Dark Star, give me that Dark Star. Sorry,
I still haven't seen Dark Star.
You don't need to.
Okay, all right.
Dan O'Bannon wrote it. I need to revisit it. Dan O'Bannon co-wrote it with him. It's like, how can I not love this movie?
How bad can it really be?
Oh, it really is bad. I just remembered. Oh yeah, it's bad. It was a mistake. It was a mistake. Oh boy, and I know that has a cult following like crazy, and it's like, nope, not for me.
Well, Bill, can I do two more?
Sure, go ahead. I'll just take a nap.
All right, that sounds good.
Make them snappy, Johnny. Make them snappy.
I'll just blather on. Well, I know we'll disagree on this one, Bill, but, you know, I have an interesting relationship with Rob Zombie. Don't tell his wife. but, you know, of course... Everybody was kind of like excited about House of a Thousand Corpses because, hey, known shock rocker Rob Zombie, hey, he went and made a movie for Universal. And then, you know, this was in 1998 and it was shelved for 5 freaking years before Lionsgate picked it up and released it. I think they gave it a wide release in theaters. So I was like, you know what? I'm not a big Rob Zombie music fan, but I'll check this movie out since that's what I did at the time. I just went out to matinees. I'd still be doing that if, you know, our circumstances were different stateside. Yeah. But, so in any case, you know, I go to this movie. I think I'm one of the only people in the theater. I'm like, oh my God, what is this fucking music video abomination, no plot, cringe humor. Good Lord, this thing is terrible. Movie, and I'm not going to talk about House of a Thousand Corpses because I still think it sucks.
No, I hate that movie. I can't even watch it beyond 15 minutes.
Yeah, it's a really shrill, grating, obnoxious thing, and it's very much Rob Zombie. It's like, hey, I want to make a feature film, but I just want to make it like a bunch of my music videos, and that's and show people how much I love Toby Hooper. So despite this, I went to see The Devil's Rejects in the theater back in 2005 because I'm like, you know, I don't know if at the time I was just a glutton for punishment or if I was thinking to myself, hey, it's getting some good reviews, including Ebert and Roper gave it 2 thumbs up, which I was shocked by. And, you know, people in the horror community were just like going on about it. And so I'm like, okay, I'll go check this thing out. I remembered hating that thing while I was sitting in the theater watching it.
You're watching and brewing and stewing, huh?
Yeah, pretty much just totally like, good Lord, this thing is so tone deaf. It's just, it's ugly. It's unpleasant. The characters are still shrill, but it looks more like a movie than House of a Thousand Corpses. So, you know, I gave it a little credit for that. But still I was like, I don't need to experience this again. And so a couple of years after that, you know, word comes out that Rob is remaking Halloween. And you know what? Going back to Carpenter, neither one of us are fans of Halloween. So I was actually interested to see what he would bring to Halloween, despite my experiences with House of a Thousand Corpses and The Devil's Rejects. So in preparation for Halloween coming to theaters, being released, I went back and revisited House of a Thousand Corpses and The Devil's Rejects. Still didn't like House of a Thousand Corpses, but I was surprised that I liked, in air quotes, The Devil's Rejects the second time around. So I'm thinking to myself, why is that?
Yeah, you why know? Is that, Johnny? Tell us.
Well, it has something to do with my mother, I believe. No. Dr. Freud. But I was just wondering if I front-loaded kind of a bad attitude into the theater when I went to see The Devil's Rejects. I wondered if I was just hoping to dislike it, because I was in that place where a lot of jerky internet people are back then, of like, oh, it's just fun to like anonymously hate on stuff. I did find the movie obnoxious. I do remember finding it obnoxious, but then watching it again, I was like, something about zombies, style and craft, I think, came through more to me. You know, he has that sort of predisposition toward kind of his vulgar elementary school humor. But, you know, I thought the interactions between the characters were good. More so the style, and there's just a real grit to that film. And it does kind of raise some questions, because at first the cops are raiding the Firefly's house and trying to get them in custody. And then, you know, the Fireflies do some awful things to like a traveling musician group in a hotel. But then we discover that the cop that's trailing them is kind of like this religious fundamentalist who's thinks he can do whatever he wants to because he has God's approval.
Right.
So there's this self-righteousness going on. So there's this weird kind of morally murky morass that Zombie kind of sets up. And he does that in a couple of his movies, where it's kind of like, well, who is really the, who's the worst, who's the bad guy, who's the worst of these two really bad groups of people, you know? And I find that kind of interesting, the way he conveys that stuff, because he even gives us moments with the Fireflies where they're actually not doing anything particularly wicked or nasty. They're eating ice cream and just carrying on. I'm like, it's like, you know, there is something to those moments, I think. And, yeah, I think he's good at setting up kind of those kind of moral, philosophical quandaries that the viewer kind of has to wrestle with. Like, you know, you watch Martyrs, and I'm not comparing Devil's Rejects to Martyrs.
You but better not.
Like, yeah, there's kind of this thing of like, it's like, well, you know, why are you watching? Why are you letting yourself get pummeled by this thing?
Yeah.
Kind of, because it is like, it's tough. It's unpleasant. You know, but maybe there are some truths and some accuracies under the surface of things. There's a purpose behind it. When it seems pointless is when it starts to get on my nerves. When you're just kind of showboating for shock value's sake, and it's really kind of hard to describe with The Devil's Rejects and even some of Zombie's other stuff, because it's like it's because he really walks a line, and it's he's walking it like the guy who walked between the World Trade Center towers back in the 70s. It's a very fine line. He's walking, because one wrong move and you're plummeting, you know, to the earth. And maybe that's one of the reasons I'm kind of fascinated by that film, but also why I can't watch it too often, because again, like The Last House on the Left remake, it's a tough movie that,
right,
you know, kind of hit at a time in the mainstream where, you know, Saw had just been successful. So it kind of opened the floodgates for these more harder edged films. So yeah,
I gotcha.
So yeah.
All right. And you have one more?
Well, I don't have to if you don't want to.
It's up to you, man. I don't care. I'm not doing anything. You're talking. I'm just hanging here playing with myself. I mean, I'm just hanging here.
Well, the two go hand in hand, don't they, Bill? Well, you know, maybe the last one, and it's kind of big because it's grown into, again, one of my favorite movies by the director, and it's a director who I've liked for a long time, and it's the original Day of the Dead.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. Man, I want to love that movie, but the comedy kills it for me, man. I can't do it.
Oh, well, what are you talking about specifically?
The mall, right?
The Day of the Dead.
Holy crap, I'm sorry. Oh, my God. I'm drinking.
Yeah, in the bunker. Yeah,
what do you think in the bunker. I thought that was really cool, man. I really got into that. I thought that was really neat. What did I rate that one as? Day of the Dead. What did I do? I got to check.
Okay. Oh, man. All right.
Yeah, go ahead. Do your thing.
Well, you know, it's a movie I did not like when I first saw it. And I think part of it was the it's a very caustic film, I think. I would call it caustic, because, you know, like you were saying about Dawn of the Dead, that's more of a romp. It has a lot more humor in it, you know, whether it's incidental or intentional or slapstick or whatever. And with this one, it's very serious. You know, there's some gallows humor running through it, but it's mostly very much, you know, the situation's deteriorated. Science and the military are in a bunker butting heads over what to do with the undead who are kind of trying to slam down the gate outside. You know, and I was just like, man, this movie is just, it's like a movie that was just unpleasant to watch.
It was very intimate.
Yeah, it is. And it's almost claustrophobic in that sense that you're stuck in that. I mean, granted, it's a big bunker, but you still feel that sense of the walls closing in. And again, I think I was pretty young when I watched it, maybe 17 or 18. And I was just like, well, and I also didn't find the characters too interesting, maybe because they were just so much, they seemed like just either really bad guys or really good guys or just apathetic people. And I'm just like, I didn't really latch on to anybody while I was watching it. So I think that was kind of a kiss of death while I was watching it. You know, gotcha. I found it interesting because I felt like there was a lot of, and other people have said this too, like the first hour is kind of slow. There's a lot of talk and speechifying, and, you know, that's not inaccurate. It's mostly characters just hanging around and talking in the early going of that film.
Right. I didn't mind that though.
Yeah. You know what? And I think again, it's like watching Dead Ringers at a young age and not picking up on the nuances of it, you know, other things where it's just like, you know, I hadn't watched enough movies to kind of appreciate certain maybe subtle things that were being done, or even quite understanding what the characters were arguing about, like the implications of it, just because I'm like, I'm still a kid. I don't understand. but, you know, again, it's like that's a movie I was drawn to, and I would find a way to watch it and rewatch it through the years. And eventually it did get to a point where I was like, I don't know when. It might have been when I was in college in the early or mid 2000s, where I was like, you know what, this is pretty damn good.
That's cool.
And I think it is probably, it's probably second to Night for me in terms of the Living Dead series. Because I think maybe now that I've gotten older and had some life experience, you know, you look at the state of the world today and I'm like, you know what? The way the military and science butt heads in that bunker is not altogether different from certain things that are going on in our real life situation right now. So I'm like, okay, you know, you're a perceptive guy, George Romero. It's like, I do really like the movie a lot now, because I think there is that bleakness and kind of outnumbered despair of the situation. What is it? I think Logan says it's like, what, 400,000 to one is the zombie to human ratio or something like that.
Yeah, it sort of sucks, those numbers, you know?
Yeah.
Sort of sucks.
Yeah, it doesn't present things in quite the greatest light, so I can understand how that would lead to tension. So, yeah, you know, and I think I like the movie a lot more now because I like actually the dialogue stuff more than the actual zombie stuff that happens in the last act, which maybe sounds weird, but the way Romero writes the interactions and the dialogue exchanges, and there's even this great moment with Rhodes, played by Joe Pilato, who, you know, the scientists are talking about stuff like their theories and how they look to combat or reverse the undead process, basically.
Right.
And he says something, and I love this line. He's like, when are you going to show us something we can understand?
Yep.
And I love that kind of underlines the, okay, you're scientists, you went to college for how God knows how long, and you have all this knowledge in your noggin. We're just military guys. What do you expect of us? We gotta run this operation. And it's almost like in that moment, he's like saying, even though he's an asshole, he's almost saying, hey, he could have said it differently. He could have said, could you guys please meet us at our level? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and just like in a non, but, yeah, it's like, I really like those moments in the film because I think it's, again, what Romero does best is he shows the zombies are kind of incidental, ultimately. Yes,
exactly.
It's more about the breakdown of civil society and humans and their inability to see eye to eye and get along with each other. And for some reason, like those Twilight Zone episodes, Bill, like 12 Angry Men, it never gets old.
No, it doesn't.
Because we don't learn our lesson. Yeah.
No, we never have. I mean, you know, I remember studying all of the African tribes that were selling out other African tribes because they were their traditional enemy to slave traders instead of banding together to stop the slave traders, you know, and in our fledgling United States, you know, one Native American tribe would be scouts for the military, the fledgling U.S. military, and, you know, say, yeah, those are the Indians you want over there. Mm-hmm. And, they didn't band together, you know. Chief Pontiac, you know, helped, you know, unite some tribes, but it was like too little too late. You know, people don't see, it's like they're concerned about their traditional enemy, not the new enemy in front of them. You know, you can't trust, you know, you can't trust that new source. And, you know, you could say the same thing's happening in the United States right now. We have the whole red versus blue crap, and that's insane. And all of this other stuff mixed in. We're fighting amongst ourselves, yet a nation, you know, launched a cyber attack against us, you know, several years ago. And it's like, that you know, isn't our way of life maybe, you know, are we exposed? Like, shouldn't we worry about that outside threat instead of, like, going at each other's throats. And so I don't know.
Well, yeah, sometimes I think to myself, Bill, like when we can fight each other on social media and fight our neighbors in the streets or whatever, you know what I'm saying? It's like when we can yell at people through other means, that certainly makes the job of the people that are pulling the strings and all this a lot easier, because it's like, oh, well, as long as they fight each other instead of fighting us,
sure,
then we're in the clear.
True.
Hey,
I think a lot of, I think a lot of politicians love that, because it's like, you know, we just have to add fuel to fires and, you know, talk about certain things that aren't necessarily, you know, shouldn't be within the realm of government or governmental control.
Yeah.
And we'll have them at each other's throats. So while they're arguing at that, you and I will share scotch. We'll take their money. And I don't know, you know, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it just seems like, you know, anytime you do stuff like that and you churn the pot so people are at each other's throats, it's like we should be maybe grow up a little bit and, you know, just talk and then focus on what the government should really be doing, you know, for anything from education to healthcare to, you know, defense and, you know, all those wonderful things that we need the government to take care of. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's okay, Bill. I don't know either.
Yeah, nobody has any answers. It's crazy. And it's just sad. You know, there's so many beautiful people in this country. And I think companies and businesses and sports teams are doing more, you know, to unite the masses than than our own government and people who, like, just take a breath. Don't have an emotional reaction, and let's talk. 1, 2, 3, go. You know, like, it's like...
It would be nice. Yeah, it would be.
It would be quite pleasant, Johnny Numb. Pleasant indeed. Wow.
Yeah, I'm going to go play Imagine now.
Yeah, exactly.
On repeat, so...
yeah, ad nauseam.
Maybe while I'm getting my turntable set up, you can scream out to some people who... They don't need a second chance. All they needed was a first chance to win their way into our hearts, Bill.
Wow. And they did that, Johnny. And these are wonderful souls that you could find on Twitter. And I'm going to give you their Twitter handle, all that fun stuff, and maybe spell some names because I think I have to. Lisa Barger. Lisa Barger, one word, all lowercase. She's on Twitter. She said, it's okay. I've never heard of you either. So there you go. She's a health influencer and writer. And she exposes EEO lawsuits, alt med scams, food safety recalls. She's also into horror movies. And you can check out her work on Amazon.com at her own shop at Lisa Barger. I'm going to totally butcher this person's name. Please forgive me. Ojalele Mascarin. And that is on Twitter. Fajarnugros, film director, head of IDN Pictures. Bad opinions are my own. How could you not love this person? And also check them out on YouTube. Maya _LEL Curry, KHOURY, passionate about empowering the world with positivity. Master marketing and communication, certified NLP and leadership coach. All my posts are copyrighted. And out of Dubai, United Arab Emirates, and also go to the website mayalcoury.com. Tim Edwards at Tim Edwards Zero, Z-E-R-O, number 4, music, art, science, technology, horror, animals, United States Air Force, Blender 3D, progressive, follow back out of Huntsville, Alabama. You could also follow Ted Edwards on Instagram. The great people. At Trauma Team, Trauma _ Team at Trauma Entertainment, 46 years of disrupting media, movies of the future. I just love it. They know how to market. Terror Firmer, 20th anniversary Blu-ray available now. And of course, hashtag Shakespeare Shitstorm, the latest and greatest from the man, the myth, the living legend. Who is he, Johnny?
Lloyd Kaufman.
Absolutely. It says coming soon, but it's here. Long Island City, New York at Trauma.com. Check him out. Trauma is traumatic, and you got to love them. Tony Newton, the number one writer, poet, screenwriter, filmmaker, author, producer. Also check out at Creator. of VHS Lives and Troma's Grindsploitation, Horror Poet, VHS Dark Poet. Go to tonynewton.net out of London, England, and also check Tony Newton on imdb.com. Scare Tissue Com, horror movie reviews and news from folks who love the genre. That's cool. We love them already. A bad horror movie is still probably worth watching once.
Oh, yeah.
Who can deny that logic? ScarTissue.com. Check them out. The Asylum CC, a 21st century film studio, producer of Sharknado, Z Nation, and 300 other films. 300! I can't count that high. Drawing the line at boring dramas, we have standards. I love it. They're all about having fun and beyond, and they're out of Burbank, California. Check out their website at theasylum.cc. Garbage Barf. What's that? That's actually Garbage Barf Breakdown. Bad movie reviews and random weirdo nonsense. B-movies, cult movies, VHS, retro gaming, girls, nerd, YouTuber. Sounds like this is perfect. Check out our YouTube channel for more. You doof. Go to your Garbage Barf Breakdown YouTube channel. Last but not least, Johnny, before we sign off, Best Costumes 3, the number 3, besthalloweencostumesonline.com provides the best place and the widest selection of costumes to choose from online. They're out of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. So those are our scream outs for tonight's show, John. We're good.
Awesome. Awesome.
Where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Johnny Num. There are no H's in those Johnnies or Nums. You can also find...
Sorry,
where
go ahead.
The hell can people find me? You can find my writing at CrashBallasProductions.com because Billy is a sweetheart.
Oh, God.
And you can also find my writing at 1428elm.com because... Susan on the Ledge, Susan Layton, is also a sweetheart. So there we go. What about you, Billy? Talking like a noir detective here.
I know, and that's why you said 1428 Elm. Isn't it 1408? Which one is it, Johnny?
1428.
Okay, good. Just wanted to make sure that we were all on the same page.
1408 is the Stephen King movie with John Cusack.
Yeah, which I didn't really like the third act. But anyway, that's just me. You can find me at CrashPalaceProductions.com and also on Twitter as Crash Palace. And you could also find me at Noir Kink for links to my erotic crime thrillers. And the new one is out, the third in the series, Debauchery. You could find that on Kindle and paperback on Amazon at William D. Prystauk. Just put in... PRYSTAUK. It'll pop up because I'm one of only 5 left in the world. That's it, Johnny.
Bill, I'm in the midst of reading The Haunting of Hill House for the first time.
Nice!
And I'm loving it. I received Debauchery in the mail last week, so that's what I'm going to get into after I'm done with The Haunting of Hill House.
Oh, man. Give me your honest opinion, man.
Absolutely. I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Way to sell it, Bill. Way to sell it.
No, I just need to hear from you and a couple of other people first because I tried something a little bit different. So.
Well, and I flipped through it a little bit, Bill, and I saw the passage about Banter's Hard Cider. So that's already at least one star in your favor there. So
yeah, I had to put it. And it's funny, ever since I wrote that, Banter's has been closed down because of the virus and quarantine. It is open though. You can come up here to Stroudsburg and get your get your cider. And on October 3rd of this year, at Downriver Brewery on Main Street in Stroudsburg, I will be there selling books, signing books. That's from 3 to 6 p.m. October 3rd.
Oh, that's awesome, man. I was wondering about if you were going to have a signing or something.
Well, the great Steve Brancato, who owns both Banner Cider and Downriver Brewery, he said, Billy, you got to do it. And I'm like, I'm doing it. So I'm doing it. So there it is.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah, it is. So thank you, Steve, and thank you all those beautiful people who work at both of those fine establishments for drinking, eating, fun, and more.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can vouch for that because I've been to both of them too. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Bill.
That's it.
I'm gonna go eat something, Bill.
Yeah, me too. I'm starving, man. The noise you hear in the background is my housemate Cheryl prepping dinner.
I will leave you two to it then.
Yeah, and I'm gonna clean up afterwards, so because I make a mess.
Oh man.
Yeah, I know. On that note.
All right. See you, Bill.
Bye, Johnny.